Coming up, people of faith practicing what they call ethical eating. They say food is more than just food.
It touches personal health. It touches education, the social development of people, right? As well as touching economic issues and ecological issues. So food needs to be a priority.
And a doctor, teacher, and writer on medicine as a calling.
My desire to be a physician had a lot to do with that sense of medicine as a ministry of healing, not just a science.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. The Vatican issued new rules for the handling of clergy sex abuse this week. The revised standards extend the statute of limitations on sex abuse cases and increase penalties for the possession by priests of child pornography. Many of the policies for handling abuse were already in place, but the new document makes them official church law. The document also called attempting to ordain women a grave crime against the church, provoking criticism for seeming to treat female ordination and pedophilia as equally serious offenses. Argentina has become the first country in Latin America to legalize same-sex marriage. The Catholic Church there was joined by evangelical Christians and Mormons in protesting the new law, which narrowly passed. It grants gay married couples all the same legal protections as heterosexual couples, including the right to adopt children and inherit wealth. In Uganda, religious leaders are cautioning against retaliation for two bombings that killed more than 70 people in the city of Kampala. Nate Henn of Delaware, 25 years old and a volunteer with a humanitarian aid group, was among those killed in the attacks. Several missionaries from a church in Pennsylvania were wounded. A Somali terrorist group claimed responsibility and reportedly bragged of killing many Christians in the attacks. Prayer vigils were held for the victims at their U.S. churches. Some counterterrorism experts are criticizing President Obama for his decision to drop references to Islamic radicalism from official national security language. The president said such language alienates Muslims. However, a new report from the Washington Institute for Near East Policy objects to the refusal to recognize the religious motivations of many terrorists. The report says omitting any reference to Islamic extremism prevents moderate Muslims from speaking up against the radical teachings. France is now one step closer to banning face-covering veils like the burqa or the niqab in public places. The country's National Assembly voted overwhelmingly for the proposed law, which would fine women who wear the veil in public. Supporters cite France's tradition of secularism and concerns over gender equality as reasons for the ban. The legislation goes to the French Senate in September, where it's expected to be approved. According to a recent poll from the Pew Research Center, a large majority of French citizens support the ban, as do residents of other Western European countries. Nearly 30% of Americans said they would support a similar ban here. American Jews from the Reform and Conservative movements are protesting a new bill making its way through the Israeli parliament that would give Orthodox rabbis there more control over conversions to Judaism. Currently, Israel recognizes only conversions performed by Orthodox rabbis inside Israel. People converted by non-Orthodox rabbis outside the country are currently eligible for Israeli citizenship, but if the new bill passes, non-Orthodox converts outside Israel fear that they would no longer be eligible for citizenship. A raucous hearing in New York City this week over plans to build a mosque and community center two blocks from Ground Zero. The building that the mosque would replace was damaged in the September 11th attacks. Opponents of the mosque want the building declared a city landmark, meaning it could not be torn down. Planners of the Islamic Center want it to be a monument to religious tolerance, but one critic called the project, quote, sacrilege on sacred ground. This week marked the six-month anniversary of the devastating earthquake in Haiti, which killed more than 230,000 people. Humanitarian groups say while there's been some recovery, an overwhelming amount of work still needs to be done. An estimated 1.5 million Haitians continue to be homeless, many enduring the rainy season in flimsy tarps and tents. Our managing editor, Kim Lawton, has been covering faith-based efforts in Haiti. She's been there twice since the earthquake. Kim, welcome. What do you hear?
Well, obviously, there's a lot of frustration among the humanitarian community. The people that have been down there for 6 months now working, they're frustrated by so many problems that have kept them from doing all the good they'd like to do. I mean, there's just so many obstacles. You've got still a ton of rubble that's around, nowhere to put it. Bureaucracy. The infrastructure of the country was so devastated, so that the bureaucracy in place is cumbersome.
They say they can't get the supplies through customs.
Right, right. Building things, getting things through customs, figuring out which office needs to approve what and who needs to, you know, what fees need to be paid. So that's really frustrating for them. And, you know, there are land issues. A lot of these tarps and tents have been set up on land that belongs to somebody else. And so straightening out that, you can't build a more permanent housing if you can't figure out whose land it is.
Yeah. I have a friend who's seen a lot of relief efforts all over the world, and he says he's never seen any place where there were so many Christian relief groups.
Well, certainly many of these Christian groups and other faith groups really felt connected to Haiti. They'd been working there in the past, and so they have spent a lot of time. There are just a huge number of volunteers going down trying to help out. And we should say that even amidst all of the problems and the fact that more progress hasn't been made, they say there has been progress. You know, there are some positive things, too.
And some things haven't happened that might have and that people feared, like epidemics and terrible security problems.
Well, mass starvation. I mean, when you think about it, people aren't starving to death there. They're hungry, yes, but they're not starving to death. And so I think I'm hearing a lot from the faith community, people saying it's going to take a really long time. We knew that going in, and we've seen that 6 months in. But people shouldn't give up hope because they think things can be done.
Kim Lawton, many thanks. In other news, a growing number of people of faith are adopting what they call ethical eating. If you're out of work and counting every penny, this approach to food may be too costly. Others may find it takes too much time, and the food industry thinks it's unnecessary. But, as Judy Valente reports, many church groups are finding that ethical eating has religious value.
Mary Jo McMillan is a cookbook author from the Chicago suburbs. When she shops, she looks for fruits and vegetables that are in season, preferably locally grown. She doesn't buy processed foods or fast food, and make sure she knows where the meat she's buying comes from. It's not just about green eating or even healthful eating, but eating ethically.
I've been using this brand of chicken for a long time, and I've researched them, and I know that they come from not very far away, and they're produced on small farms. It's done with high standards of, they're fed a vegetarian diet, they're raised on these Amish farms. I mean, they're sort of religious chickens, you know.
But there's nothing funny about the way some large factory farms operate. Advocates of ethical eating protest the way animals are often kept in crowded, unsanitary conditions and injected with growth hormones and antibiotics. Norman Wurzba is professor of theology, ecology, and rural life at Duke University.
Cattle are meant to eat grass, to live in pasture. Chickens are meant to roam and be outside. And when you think about how industrial eating practices, right, stifle that inner drive, this natural drive that these animals have. It's a violation of their ability to be what they are.
Another frequent criticism of the food industry is the widespread use of preservatives and artificial flavoring to prolong shelf life.
Now, that's not to say we don't do any processing, right, or any refrigeration or any preserving. No, we have to do some of that. But we don't need to do it to the degree that we do, because as we do more of it, what we're discovering is that we are paying for it with our own illness.
We have the safest, least expensive, most abundant food supply in the world, and that's no accident.
Tara Smith of the American Farm Bureau Federation.
You can find nutritious food year-round in the grocery store, and if you look and you're willing to buy certain products, you can find relatively inexpensive, healthy food products year-round.
Ethical eating means looking at food as more than a commodity, and eating is not merely a biological function. Eating, it is said, connects us with the deeply mysterious and miraculous character of life.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
This one is a little larger than this one, as you can see.
Many Americans are getting back to the garden. These students in Cedar Grove, North Carolina, brave intense summer heat as they learn to grow fruits and vegetables in a community garden.
You can just pull it right out and you just rinse them off and you can eat them.
Right here we have sweet potatoes that are doing fabulously, as you can tell.
Kate Forer, who manages the garden, is also an ordained minister.
Having the experience of planting a seed and having the faith that it'll grow into a plant that will eventually sustain me is a spiritual experience. And ultimately, I really, really feel like food is a sacred gift from God, and that's something that we tend to forget about in our culture.
Small faith communities like this one are sprouting up all across the country to advance the cause of ethical eating, teaching more than just good gardening practices.
I also feel like we're teaching people how to cultivate peace in their communities just by working together, just by doing a task together. That's not always easy or fun. I mean, sometimes gardening is hot and frustrating and stressful, but being able to work through those things together can be really powerful.
For others, personal gardening is also an opportunity for spiritual growth. Every day, Mary Jo McMillan walks about a half mile to a public park where for a yearly fee of $32, she can cultivate her own plot of land and her prayer life.
Going to the garden is a part of a spiritual practice for me. I use that time to think about what I'm thankful for and to try to remember people in my past that I'm thankful for and my family that surrounds me now. It's just my daily meditation. I feel I'm in a place where things are really alive and growing. We're all so busy with our adding extra hours to our fitness routine, adding an extra hour to our email, Twitter, and Facebook, whatever. But maybe we need really to sometimes add that extra hour to what we're ingesting, what we're feeding ourselves with.
I don't know about you, but I certainly don't have time to make every loaf of bread I eat.
What about the person who says, I'm busy, I don't have time to worry about where my food comes from?
And I think we need to make food a priority, because food touches so much. It touches personal health, it touches education, the social development of people, right, as well as touching economic issues and ecological issues. So food needs to be a priority.
One downside to eating ethically, at least these days, is that it's probably going to cost more, as shoppers often discover when they buy organic food or from local farmers markets.
Right now, during these economic times, we have one out of every eight Americans is currently on food stamps. Budgets when it comes to purchasing food items are very important to most American households.
I know that there's a lot of concern about the fact that if you want to buy organic food, it's more expensive, or if you want to buy locally produced food, it's more expensive. But we have to ask the question, well, what do we really value? Right? Do we value healthy land, clean water, vibrant farm communities?
I certainly feel like my nutrition is my personal responsibility, and I think that folks should take some personal responsibility for being sure that their diet is the way that it should be. There is no lack of option for food products here in the United States. If you don't choose to eat those healthy food products, though, no one can force feed them to people.
The importance of food or sharing a meal is deeply rooted in religious tradition. McMillan, for instance, bakes the fresh bread her congregation uses at its communion services.
It takes us back to the point that this really isn't just a big symbolical ritual. It's also a meal that feeds both the body and the spirit. So many families have come up to me in the church and said, our children just love to have real bread at communion.
It's good to see everybody here.
In most of the world's religions, eating traditionally involved a blessing and an expression of thanks, a practice Forer and others say has become all but lost in our mass production, fast food culture.
All right, let's pray. Gracious God, we give you thanks for grace is a way of pausing and remembering the Creator who has given us this. But for me, grace is also a way to acknowledge the other people who have brought the food to us.
Saying grace, besides being a sort of ritual act, I think is also a political act. Because if you're truly saying grace and you're remembering this food that you're about to eat, you should also be committing yourself to the well-being of the sources of that food.
I remember my mother sitting in front of a perfectly ripened peach. Maybe we had peach trees, the first ones that we had, and saying, I'm going to eat this very slowly. Just think how long it took to grow.
Advocates of ethical eating say if we pay more attention to where our food comes from, we will begin to see it not as something that just happens, but as a gift. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Judy Valente in Cedar Grove, North Carolina.
We have a profile now of a man you can't help wanting to know. He's Abraham Verghese, a doctor, writer, teacher, and advocate of medical practice as a vocation, a calling. Fred DeSam-Lazaro has the story of Dr. Verghese's many skills and the idea of the Samaritan healer.
We're looking for fusion, we're looking for...
Abraham Verghese has all the credentials and degrees befitting a professor at Stanford Medical School, but he's best known and acclaimed for his writing, two best-selling memoirs and a new work of fiction that evoke a different kind of medical vocation.
My desire to be a physician had a lot to do with that sense of medicine as a ministry of healing, not just a science, and not even just a science and an art, but also a calling, also a ministry.
His goal is to have today's medical students aspire similarly to a calling as much as a career in medicine, to awaken a more basic curiosity as they sharpen their clinical acumen. These third-year medical students were studying abnormalities on a scan, specifically the prominence of certain blood vessels.
This is what's called pulmonary redistribution. Have you heard that term? It's an early sign of heart failure. Who's got good hand veins that I can borrow?
Verghese offered a simple physics explanation of why blood vessels should not normally be visible above the level of the heart.
The level of her right atrium is about here. Okay, so watch what happens as I raise her hand. You still see the veins? Nice three dimension, right? See how they're flattening out? And they are gone.
The bottom line, well before an x-ray, a doctor might spot telltale signs of disease.
And you see their neck veins, and they're not coughing, speaking, singing, straining. They have increased venous pressure.
Increasingly, he says, students and practitioners of medicine in the West rely on technology in a system that stresses cognitive knowledge and machines over the skill that comes from touch and feel.
I'm the first to admit that the resolution of a hand feeling the belly doesn't compare with the resolution of a CAT scan scanning the belly. But only my hand can say that it hurts at this spot and not at this spot. Only my hand can say that. Only my hand can say that this pulsatile mass, which might be an aneurysm, is also painful, which is therefore maybe a leaking aneurysm. You know, there are nuances to the exam that no machine is going to give you.
It's a theme Verghese has sounded repeatedly over the years, writing in magazines including The New Yorker and Atlantic, and now in a bestseller called Cutting for Stone. It fulfills a long-held desire to write fiction, as he told this book club in Menlo Park, California.
Dorothy Allison, a wonderful American writer, she says, fiction is the great lie that tells the truth about how the world lives.
The setting for Verghese's novel is far from Silicon Valley, a mission hospital in Ethiopia. It is a textured 650-page narrative set amid that country's turmoil in the 60s and 70s. Its stories of medicine, doctors, and future doctors at the hospital all illustrate what the author calls the Samaritan role of the healer. Verghese went from med school in India to Boston, Tennessee, Texas, then Stanford. He was born and raised in Ethiopia to parents originally from Kerala, India, and from its Syriac Orthodox traditions. Faith was a big part of life for this and other expatriate communities in the Addis Ababa of his youth, which may unwittingly have shaped some of the novel's characters.
You said that what really inspired you to write the book was you wanted to write a book that would get people interested perhaps in medicine.
Yeah.
But there was so much in the book about faith.
Yes.
And different types of faith. And so how did you come to have so much of this, of another theme in your book?
Well, you know, the honest answer is I don't really know. It just sort of all evolved that way. And I think when you're in medicine, you agonize over matters of faith.
The confluence of faith and medicine and the Mission Hospital itself attracted Duke University Divinity School Dean Gregory Jones to Verghese's book. It was a timely find, just before a recent trip to discuss his church's own mission work.
It becomes a shaping institution that plays a really significant role in developing, in any developing country, and one that we need to pay a lot more attention to. My trip to London was actually to deal with issues around southern Sudan. And so I was struck by the significant role this hospital was playing in the novel about Ethiopia.
And even though its setting seems distant, Jones says the novel's context is very relevant to many students he sees at Duke.
I think a lot of Christians go into nursing or medicine or other health-related vocations out of a deeply formed and felt Christian vocation, but sometimes the practice of healthcare in the United States particularly often pushes those apart. And I think the novel portrays that in a really beautiful way.
I joke, but only half joke, that if you show up in an American hospital missing a finger, no one will believe you till they get a CAT scan, MRI, and orthopedic consult.
All the emphasis on machines, he says, adds cost to the healthcare system and comes at the expense of one of our most important rituals, a visit with one's doctor.
Rituals are about transformation. You know, we marry with great ceremony to signal a transformation. We are baptized in a ritual to signal a transformation. The ritual of one individual coming to another and confessing to them things they wouldn't tell their spouse, their preacher, their rabbi, and then even more incredibly, disrobing and allowing touch, which in any other context would be assault. You know, tell me that that's not a ritual of great significance. If we shortchange the ritual by not being attentive or you're inputting into the computer while the patient's talking to you, you basically are destroying the opportunity for the transformation. And what is a transformation? It's the sealing of the patient-physician bond.
Ironically, Verghese says research is emerging that corroborates the importance of this bond, the virtue of the Samaritan healer.
We're learning that you can have a powerful effect on patients or a powerful negative effect on patients based on context, based on your tone of voice. They're actually associated with significant chemical changes in the brain. The Parkinson's patient's dopamine levels go up with a placebo. We're now able to show that the words of comfort trigger biological reactions, which are the very things that you want. And you can use drugs to get there, or you can use words of comfort to get there, which would make your drugs so much more effective. It's an incredible insight in, you know, a couple of decades now of practicing medicine. It's lovely to come full circle to where I started, but with the science to back it up.
For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSamlazaro.
A name change is in the works for a once powerful religious organization, often known only by its initials. The Young Men's Christian Association has announced it will no longer go by the acronym YMCA. Now it is simply the Y. Officials unveiled a new logo.
It is bold, it is vibrant, it is welcoming, and we believe it is certainly inspirational. And most importantly, it captures the personality of our organization.
And finally, on our calendar this week, Jews around the world mark the solemn holiday of Tisha B'Av this Tuesday. Tisha B'Av is a day of fasting and lament for the destruction of the first and second temples in Jerusalem and other tragedies in Jewish history. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. We'd like to hear from you. You can follow us on our Facebook page. We also have much more on our website. You can comment on all of our stories and share them. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, we remember Bishop Walter Hawkins, the Grammy Award-winning gospel singer and songwriter who passed away this week at the age of 61 after a battle with cancer. He was a major influence for many of today's top gospel artists.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Next time, faith-based groups trying to help those along the Gulf Coast devastated by the oil spill. Hundreds still have not received any outside aid. And the Christians of Iraq, as many as a third of them, have fled the country because of persecution since the American invasion. I'm Bob Abernethy. Join us for the next Religion and Ethics News Weekly.